Welcome to another exciting episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm your host and choir executive editor, Burl Love. And this is our special pre-election, everything you need to know. Well, not everything, but just the important stuff. So with me in the podcast studios overlooking Paycor Stadium on a cloudy day in Cincinnati, we have Scott Wortman, our City Hall City Politics reporter. Scott, welcome.
Excited to be here.
All right. You've been busy.
Yeah, there's been a few things going on at City Hall. And
just a few things.
And a few candidates out there as well.
All right. And then our new-ish education reporter, Grace Tucker. Grace.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
How's the new beat going? I mean, you switched from being one of our standout trending news reporters, TikTok star on the Inquirer TikTok channel. And now you're jumping into the serious, important topic of education. How's it going?
Yeah, it's definitely a big shift. But I think, ironically, starting around the top of the school year in September has been good, kind of meeting all the folks on the scene. And going to school board meetings, it's definitely a hectic time. It's election season. Hectic time to be covering schools, hectic time to be in school.
So you're like drinking through a fire hose?
A little bit, sure.
All right. Well, if any of our listeners out there have ideas for education stories for Grace, you know how to get a hold of us.
Yes.
Well, should we jump in?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right, Scott, we're going to start with you and the mayoral election between incumbent Democrat Aftab Perval and his challenger, Republican-endorsed Cory Bowman, asterisk, half-brother of Vice President J.D. Vance.
Yes, yeah, there's been a few stories on that.
A few stories on that. Someone was just asking me the other day if I think that the turnout is going to be more than a typical city election because of the high profile nature of Bowman.
That's always a hard thing to predict. Like the last time we had a large field like this for city council, it was about a quarter of the voters that showed up. That was in 2021. The last one, there were only 10 candidates. 2021 is probably the most the closest analogy you could look to. Now, there are some extenuating circumstances, given that, you know, all the drama surrounding Police Chief Thichy and what, you know, her job and situation looks like, and the way crime has really dominated, you know, concerns about crime in the city, how that's dominated this election cycle. Is that going to draw people out? I don't know. I mean, there have been so many times where you look at an issue, like in the primary, for instance, everyone was saying, Hyde Park's going to come out in force in the primary. And it really was no different than, you know, it was still a low turnout. So it's hard to kind of gauge, you know, what, you know, is going to motivate the general public versus what motivates people that are already highly engaged.
My sense, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that the police chief crisis, maybe that's a little hyperbolic, but the drama surrounding Thichy being placed on paid leave, city manager Cheryl Long starting an internal investigation, which is a weird term, on her performance, her leadership, that doesn't seem to be like, it doesn't seem to me that it's affecting Perval too much. Like, I don't see Bowman, you know, seizing it and making a big deal about it, at least not in a super public way. They almost seem to be in parallel. Is that
the city council candidates have made a lot of hay on it, like on social media, as has Bowman. Bowman hasn't really raised or spent a lot of money on advertising. Despite, you know, his connection to the vice president and being high profile in one way, it's kind of been an under the radar kind of sedate campaign overall. I don't think, I mean, As far as the mayor is concerned, he was so far ahead in the primary, got 82% of the vote compared to Bowman's, was it 12%? I don't know if it's going to move the needle much there, because, I mean, that is such a gap. But I think it could have some effect on the city council races, because first off, there are 26 candidates. That's a lot of
dilution.
Yeah, there's a spreading the votes out.
Right.
It's not going to take much to be that ninth candidate, you know, that gets on council. Plus, there's an open seat as well. I mean, there are 8 of the 9 incumbents are running. Victoria Parks is not running for re-election. So, you know, that also increases the odds that someone else that's not endorsed by the Democrats could get on council, which is a big deal, because the Democratic endorsement has been rock solid in Cincinnati for the last several elections.
It has, even sort of pushing out the classic charter candidates that were mainstays on the city council. So speaking of the charter candidates, there's one who's sort of kind of, I don't want to say ahead in the pack, because we don't do polling or anything like that, but he has been on council before. He's running as a charterite, and that's Steve Gooden, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
Talk a little bit about some of these challengers that came up in the aftermath of summer's spike in crime. And a little inside baseball information here. When we write stories that are updates of other stories, we tend to put some context and background in something called a nut graph. And so whenever we write on the police chief, we want to reference the crime that led to some of the you know, what's where we are right now. So here's the nut graph of a recent story. Thiechi's leadership has come under scrutiny following a series of high profile crimes that have drawn national attention, including the killing of Patrick Herringer and a widely shared video of a fight in downtown. So that is a very brief summary, but that seems to be, I guess, one of the catalysts for some of these candidates deciding they might have an opening to break this Democratic, you know, lock that the party has on city council right now.
I'm sure I'm muttering that graph in my sleep. I've written that or a variant of that so many times.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that has been the dominant big issue that all the challengers are hammering home, while the incumbents are trying to allay the public's fears that, you know, the city is safe. Although with the police chief being put on leave, even among some of the Democratic incumbents like Seth Walsh and Mark Jeffries, Jeff Kramerding, they've expressed displeasure about how the city administration has handled this, and they want, you know, more answers and transparency. So it's been a difficult issue for the incumbents. They're definitely, I think, sensitive to how this could play out. You have among the 26 candidates, you have a lot of candidates that were on council before. You mentioned Steve Gooden. He was the head of the Charter Party, which is a reform party that's been around for 100 years,
Let's give the quick and dirty background on the Charter Party.
It is a that's so Cincinnati kind of party.
It is so Cincinnati. So in the 1920s, class, Cincinnati's government was rife with corruption, and a new charter was established by some reformers, and this charter set up the government we largely have now, which is a council slash administration government, weak mayor until the charter was amended in 1999. So we have not a strong mayor, but a strongish mayor. But essentially, it divides the power, the political power, and separates it a little bit from the day-to-day operation of the city. So you have the council that sets policy. They handle all the legislation, but in theory, they're supposed to keep their hands off the day-to-day operation of the city, which is the administration run by a city manager in this case. Today we have Cheryl Long. That form of government, you could call it the charter form because it's in Cincinnati's charter, but it led to candidates starting back in the 20s running as charterites. And it's a tradition, talk about That's So Cincinnati, that until very recently, there's always been a city council member that identifies as a charterite. But
including Mr. Cincinnati, Jim Tarbell.
Yes, Jim Tarbell with his top hat. And also important to note, officially, the city council race is nonpartisan.
Yes.
And even the mayor's race, which we have a voter elected mayor right now instead of the original charter, which just pick somebody from city council among themselves to be the ceremonial mayor. Even that race is not divided into the traditional Democratic and Republican primary. Everybody runs. It's just a big runoff, and the top two vote getters in the primary, regardless of their endorsements or their party affiliations, move on to the election. So with that established, we have a charter party candidate, not party, a charter committee?
Committee is the official name.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Of candidates, just like the slate of candidates that voters will go into the polls with from the Republicans and the Democrats. But they have a mix of the slate has a mix of former or current Democrats and Republicans. Gooden is a Republican who
fairly conservative as far as his his views.
Yeah. And he's been very, very, very vocal on the concerns about crime and blaming the current administration and needing to be tougher on crime and addressing this. They also have Lakita Cole, who is a Democrat or has been a Democrat. She's called herself an independent Democrat since she's not on the Democratic slate this year. And she has a lot of name recognition, and there is a chance that she could get enough votes for that, you know, for one of the positions on council.
Now, refresh my memory. She has been on council, right?
Yeah. In the aughts. She resigned in 2010 to take a position with the PUCO, Public Utilities Corporation of Ohio. She's people I've talked to have seen her as a potential one that could break through the monopoly that the Democratic slate currently has on council.
Kind of.
I mean, they do.
Well, because she's still a Democrat.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So in terms of Republicans or more conservative candidates that might have a shot, we mentioned Gooden. You also have former city council member Liz Keating.
And I'd like to, because her name comes up like more often when I'm talking to like anyone about the race, they see her as the like probably that has the best chance of getting on council among the ones that aren't the nine endorsed by the Democrats. And her campaign, she announced in August, and in 2 months, she's raised $207,000, which is more than any candidate has raised the entire year for the council race.
How much did you say again?
$207,000 in 2 months.
Doesn't sound like a lot when in terms of like if you're running for Congress, but for Cincinnati City Council, that's
in 2 months.
In 2 months, that's and that's real money.
It's more than anyone else has raised all year, and it's actually more than double all but three candidates that for the entire year, and some of them are Democrats. I'm trying to remember. David Mann gave her campaign, and Kate Schroeder, who ran for Congress in 2020, I believe that was. She challenged Shab. It wasn't successful. That was before the district boundaries changed. But I've heard, you know, I mean, and this was the case when she was on council previously. There are Democrats that support her and that have supported her. She's a moderate Republican. And she's endorsed by organizations that traditionally endorse Democrats. The I'm going to get the name wrong here, the Ohio Environmental Action Fund, which is an environmental group, and the Cincinnati Equality Political Action Committee, which does a lot of LGBTQ advocacy. They've also endorsed Keating. So
yeah,
she could get a lot of crossover votes. And
and I think the business community as well.
Correct.
Is lining up behind her. And what a good time to note, she is the granddaughter of former Congressman William Keating, who also did a stint as publisher of the Cincinnati Enquirer.
Yeah. Huh.
So, yes. You did not know that, did you,
no,
Grace?
No, I did not.
Yeah, ding, the more you know.
And where does our photographer Rainbow. Michael Keating fit in there in that family?
I don't think our former photographer Michael Keating
fits. Common last name,
yes,
perhaps.
Yes, yes. Very cool. As an aside, when we were preparing to move from 312 Elm Street to our current digs at 312 Plum Street, we were, you know, going through closets and, you know, storage areas and things like that. And in the former publisher's office, I found a drawer that had some nameplates in it of former publishers. William Keating's nameplate was in there. So I gave it to Liz. I thought the Keating family might think it would be cool to have this old,
sure.
old school brass nameplate, you know, like you used to have in a, you know, if you were an executive and had your own office, there was a brass nameplate outside, you know? And so, yeah, I restored that to the Keating family.
Oh, that
family.
Was very nice. Yeah.
I know. I'm a nice guy at times.
A little aside on that, when we were moving and I was going through a drawer trying to find something, we evidently one time held the record for world's largest pinata. I saw a Guinness plaque in the...
Cincinnati did?
Yeah, the Enquirer was like sponsored it.
What? Scott, why am I just learning about this?
I don't know what happened to the plaque. It's got... Unless it got lost in the move.
Wait. What? We're going to have our historian Jeff Cease do a little story on that.
I mean, maybe somebody broke a record. I don't know.
Yeah, since then.
Was You've there a picture of this?
It was an official Guinness plaque.
Yeah, but like
it was for like 2005 or six or
how big did it have to be to set the world record?
I don't know.
Now I'm curious. All right, well, listeners, we will do some research and I will report back on a subsequent episode.
It was either pinata or something like a pinata. I don't remember. It was the world's largest
pinata adjacent
of that effect.
No, yeah. Wait a minute.
What is something like a pinata?
Pinata-esque.
It hit some, yeah, it was that, for some reason,
pinata adjacent.
Because it's been a few years since I've seen it, but I just remember, huh, how about that? Anyway.
All right. Well, what else do we need to know, Scott, about
Well, I mean,
this?
One of the other candidates I'm looking at.
Not about the pinata, yeah. But about this council race.
I could go on and on about pinatas. But, and one of the other candidates that I'm looking at that, you know, I think could potentially stand one of the better odds of getting on council is Christopher Smitherman, who's got a lot of name ID, and he's a former head of the NAACP, but here locally, but he's also aligned himself with Republicans of late, but he has a lot of name recognition and could also potentially get on council. I think has a good chance.
And he's historically been conservative, but mm-hmm. but not in the Republican Party,
yeah,
not endorsed. He's a staunch independent,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans have asked him to join their ticket, and he's continued to refuse, wanting to run independently.
And he has been, in the wake of the brawl, we're just calling it the brawl now, the end of July, whatever you want to call it, melee that went viral nationally and put Cincinnati in a terrible spotlight. He did the rounds. I heard him on Lincoln Ware, I think. I heard him on WLW. I heard him like, it was almost like he was on the street corner screaming for change and reform and very outspoken when it comes to the city's, his perception that the city has really failed the citizenry in terms of keeping them safe.
And at least twice he shared the stage with the GOP's gubernatorial candidate, Vivek Ramaswamy, just
That's
giving
right.
fiery stump speeches. I mean, really animated. And he's been very front and center on this with Republicans on the crime issue. And
all
Cincinnati.
Right. So if you were to, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Ready.
If you were to pick one of those. So we talked about Gooden. We talked about four. Which of those four do you think has the best shot?
I would say Keating probably. I mean, she's well liked among both parties. I would say she probably has the best chance, and also given the strong showing, fundraising and otherwise that she's had, she seems to have a lot of support.
And maybe if there's some, you know, voters that might not have gone to the ballot, but they're going to go vote for Corey Bowman, that could give her a little bit of an edge too.
Like,
I don't see Bowman voters voting for Smitherman, for example, but maybe, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Smitherman has endorsed Bowman, and actually, at the like town halls, I talked to people that were Smitherman supporters that liked Bowman. So I don't know. But I think Keating probably stands to get more of that vote. I think you're right.
All right. We're going to shift gears now to a couple of levies. There's so many local things on this on this upcoming election, these off presidential year elections. And this is when you tend to see your school board candidates, city council races, village council races, all of those things. And levies tend to go on these ballots too. There's a couple we're going to highlight thanks to Grace. Let's start with Lakota, which you reported is one of the largest asks of taxpayers.
Yes.
In the world, no. But it's big.
It's big. And believe it or not, the district has been the one kind of that assigned to that superlative. We tried very hard to get that confirmed with a few different state agencies, but yes, the district and some critics are calling it the largest levy in Ohio's history. Some people say it's a bit more complicated than that, but it's big. They're asking for north of $500 million in a bond issue. It's 37-year-long bond issue. To fund a facilities project that really will touch every single building in the district. And it's Butler County's largest district, so we're talking a lot of buildings.
And one of the largest districts in Ohio, frankly.
I mean, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's been growing. For those old-timers like me, there used to be just one Lakota High School.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how long ago, but it's been probably 20 years or more. It's one of those two high school districts. They have Lakota East. They have Lakota West. Mm-hmm. Campuses all over the place.
Which in this facilities plan, they're wanting to expand the two high schools and demolish a few buildings that have aging infrastructure and actually shrink the size of the district from 21 to 16 buildings, kind of in an effort to improve building conditions. That has gotten a lot of pushback from some voters since one of the buildings that they're looking to demolish was built as recently as 1992. So you've got folks asking, you know, why are these buildings that are only built 30 years ago need to be demolished? People doubting that there's anything really wrong with these facilities that, you know, needs to be completely redone through this major sweeping plan. The plan itself costs around $700 million, but Lakota was able to get some state co-funding to pair with the $500 million they're asking through the levy. So it's a big deal. Another kind of contentious aspect of the levy is the ballot language. The ballot language that folks will see on Tuesday says that the impact of the levy per a $100,000 valued home per year is going to be $208 in extra taxpayer money. But the district is saying that the impact will be less than half that, thanks to a promise to not start collecting until 2029 and this state co-funding. And the district even said that they approached the Butler County Auditor, tried to have the ballot language altered to reflect, you know, all these other circumstances, and the auditor said it didn't pan out. And so now the ballot language is reflecting something a little differently than what the district is saying. And it's got some people really up in arms. It's got people calling the district misleading, people doubting their transparency. So there's a lot of issues at play here. But then you also have teachers who are saying that there's plumbing issues, there's flooding, there's mold because of these aging buildings. So it's heavy on the minds of a lot of Butler County voters for sure.
All right. That'll be one to watch. I like watching, you know, those types of levies just so we can get a gauge on where is the taxpayer's mind. Is this a good time to put levies on the ballot? My guess is no. With inflation and, you know, now people worried about the government shutdown and things like that. Consumer spending seems to be slowing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are worried about, you know, pocketbook issues. So,
yeah.
But it's a rather affluent part of our community.
I think that's part of what makes it so interesting is it's a high performing district. Lakota schools have consistently produced great results among its students, and it's in a wealthier area. So, you know, we're seeing this sort of pushback against what in a different year might be, a standard ballot issue, a school levy is definitely noteworthy. You've got folks who say that they're being priced out of the district, folks who've been here for decades and are disappointed to see that the district is asking this of them. So, yeah, it has spurred a lot of debate on social media and all the Facebook groups and around town.
All right. Well, let's go to a older, instead of Butler County, Hamilton County district. Mount Healthy, that's another one that you focused on.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little background of where we are with this Mount Healthy school tax.
So Mount Healthy is kind of on the opposite side of things. It's in a lower income area. It has repeatedly had failed levies, both in the May primary election and last year's general election. And last year it was placed in a state of fiscal emergency by the state. So it is in a really tough financial spot and has been for years.
They've made dramatic cuts to busing and programs.
To schools, to arts, to sports. I talked with a parent there who's has a kid in the band program, and the band has just been completely dissolved almost,
disbanded.
Yeah. They can no longer travel to away games, and it's really just kind of really impacted the morale of the student body, I think, and of the parents as well, who just want transparency and effectiveness from their district. They also had some administrative issues in the kind of months leading up to them being placed in a state of fiscal emergency. There was a huge financial forecast error made by a former treasurer that kind of, I think, spurred some distrust among parents. So really the context here is that the district has been struggling, and, you know, this levy, they're proposing an additional levy that is comparatively much smaller than what Lakota has on the ballot, but they're looking to kind of climb themselves out of a financial hole that they've been in for the past few years. And just like the voters in Lakota, we're hearing the same concerns among, residents in the Mount Healthy district with the pinch of inflation, with rising cost of living, rising housing costs, rising property taxes. It's people are not wanting to pay more funds towards their local school district, whether it's a high performing district like Lakota or one that is struggling, like Mount Healthy. It's a really tough time to be asking for more taxpayer funds. And it's also a tough time for schools. There's been a lot of debate about whether schools have been given sufficient state funds and having to rely on this local revenue. So it's a difficult climate for sure.
It's interesting because you have these kind of first generation northern suburbs. I would put like Mount Healthy. I would put Northwest Local, Forest Park, which is now Wynton Woods School District. Those used to be the northern suburbs that had the growth and in the investment. And then, like anything else, the growth kind of pushed north. And so, you know, Mason and Lakota schools are the north now, right? Those are the new booming, growing areas. And so their levy is about growing pains, you know, and trying to maintain what they have. These first generation suburban school districts, that's not where people are really moving to with young families. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're struggling just because most of those voters are, you know, done raising children. There's not as many school age children, families in sort of that first level.
Yeah. And they're experiencing an opposite problem with enrollment. I mean, Mount Healthy, I was looking just the other day at enrollment data. They dropped a couple hundred kids in enrollment just from last year to this year. So it's a difficult climate for a district like that.
All right. Well, those will be two to watch. Let's put a bow on that discussion here. I want to thank you guys and we will shift to the last segment of our podcast. All right, Scott, where are you going to be on election night?
I'll be in the newsroom.
You're not going to be at the Perval celebration party?
Well, we're first and we got immediacy, so I'm going to be ready in a state of cat-like readiness like I usually am to update. We will have people there, yes.
That's good. That's good. I'm guessing you'll be in the newsroom too, Grace.
Yes, I'll be here looking at school board races, looking at Lakota.
Well, we're going to have full team election coverage, obviously. The latest results on Cincinnati.com. An army of people will be in the newsroom that night, not just because we're covering the election, because there will be pizza.
Yes, that
there
is
will
important.
Be pizza. And we've got volunteers. We've got some special guests.
Who's that?
Helping us election night. Don't we usually have Aaron's sisters?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We family members. We actually, I think Carl is organizing some college students.
I love it.
To come in to help. It's a great experience. I did that when I was in college, helped out on election night.
Yeah, it's fun. It's exciting.
Oh,
maybe
sure
it's because I'm young,
great
but I still get kind of giddy.
Oh, I still, it's, you know, a former publisher of the Enquirer here, Rick Green, who's been an editor most of the time. He calls it the best day of the year. It's like, it's the best day of the year.
And that's the age where they're young and their spirit hasn't been crushed yet.
Yeah, I think I'm still in that boat.
We haven't crushed your
maybe
soul
after
yet,
this
Grace.
Election covering education, my spirit will be crushed. I'll be
all
a bit
right.
more jaded.
Well, I have to ask, because it's the name of the podcast, whether it's election related or not, Scott, Grace, have you experienced any moments where you're like, oh, man, that is so Cincinnati?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this qualifies as the something that's particular to Cincinnati, but it's just a cool story that I just want to tell. I fended off a hawk from my pet birds the other day. So
that Wait. Were your pet birds just flying around the neighborhood or something?
So it was a my bird on
I,
bird.
My partner and I have three birds, and we put them out on the screened-in porch.
What kind of birds? Like parakeets?
One's a cockatoo, one's a cockatiel.
Like okay, so the cockatoo, that's the giant white.
I would say maybe the size of maybe a little bit bigger than a pigeon.
And then
we have a cockatiel,
which is small.
Yeah, and a really loud and mean sun conure.
Conure. Okay.
Yeah, C-O-N-U-R-E.
I had no idea.
They're native to South America.
Me neither.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, they're out on the porch, and we hear a thunk, and then the birds are going, ah, ah, ah. Yeah, you know how birds do. And
I feel like I was there.
And I run out and there is a hawk attached to the screen just trying to get at him.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's like the world out there is, it's deadly out there. So be safe.
Maybe that's some sort of election metaphor.
The hawk did not want to mess with me and then flew away. I'm like, be gone. So anyway, that's my That's So Cincinnati story.
That's pretty cool.
It has really nothing to do with the city, but I just wanted to tell it.
Maybe it's a That's So Scott.
Yeah.
That's So Scott story.
It is.
That should be a recurring segment on our podcast. That's So Scott. That'd be a great podcast for you to launch just on your own.
Competitor.
Yeah. Very good. What about you, Grace? Now, you're kind of a relative newcomer to Cincinnati.
I am, yeah. I just had my 2-year anniversary. I grew up in the suburbs of Indianapolis, north of Indy. I'm a Hoosier. Went to school in Michigan. So I'm really just making the rounds in all the Midwestern states.
Yeah.
Yes. Been here 2 years. And I was racking my brain for That's What Cincinnati. I do have something, but it might more so be That's So Inquirer, but
oh,
I guess it fits.
That's even better.
I had a meeting yesterday at my bank, Chase, just like a standard, I don't know, meeting, and with this bank teller guy, you know, as adults do.
You're adulting.
Yes. And he was just making conversation. I told him I worked for the Inquirer. I report on education, yada, yada. And he was like, oh yeah, I'm from the area. I went to Xavier. Did you see that they just increased their campus living requirement? Like, I'm so mad about it. And I was like, I wrote about that yesterday.
Aww.
And he said, oh, I think I just read that story. And it was a little bit of journalism magic. And we both kind of talked about the living requirement. For those who don't know, Xavier bumped up their living requirement from 2 years to 3 years of campus living.
And people are calling it just an outright cash grab.
People are
like,
mad.
How dare
yeah.
you move off campus to an apartment when you're an upperclassman? You got to stay on campus and pay us.
Which, if you look,
know,
yeah, the rates are pretty steep for campus living. So, yeah, I don't know.
That's,
I thought that was pretty cool.
No, that's
Cincinnati,
great.
Xavier guy.
That's pretty cool.
Working at Chase.
Yeah.
It's always uplifting when you have those encounters in the wild, too, that people are listening. Reading,
it reinstills my faith in humanity. Yeah. It cuts through all of the like mean, you know, Facebook comments like, oh, this is horrible.
That's good.
It is always good to remember real world versus the internet.
Yes.
You know, whenever we go out into the community, like I get invited to speak or mm-hmm. do things like that, and a few of our more high-profile staffers, like Jason Williams, our sports columnist, and others, and Scott, you just did a Meet Scott live
did
event.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I've done a few of them this summer, just
That's
at coffee
awesome.
Shops. Those have been actually very valuable as far as like getting good story ideas. Like, I found out that the city keeps track of where the rats are, so...
That, yeah.
I had no idea. But you get interesting stuff like that, and then it's fun. Yeah.
I need you one of those, like an office hours type of situation. Yeah. Where'd you go?
I did 3 or 4 at various coffee shops.
Nice.
Like Coffee Emporium at Lookout Joe's and
love Mount Lookout Joe's.
Block Coffee in Price Hill.
Nice.
Yeah.
So when we do those community events, by and large, people are thankful for what we do. They're cheering us on. But there's always those haters out there. That'll be my So Cincinnati moment. I'll share this. We did a few years ago a Meet the Candidates night. I think you were there, Scott. And there was this guy there. And Jason Williams, back to Jason again, pointed him out. And he goes, hey, that's... And then he said this guy's Twitter handle. And... this guy just relentlessly trolling me and others about the Inquirer. And I thought, you know, I bet you in real life, he's going to be a nice guy. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Should we call him out? at Duron Dixon. Anyway, so I said, you know what? I'm going to be the bigger person. I'm going to go up and say hi. And even though he has just been brutal to me, I'm going to, you know, it's
good
part of the job, right? It's part of the job. I don't take it personally, whatever. So I wanted to meet him and thank him for coming out. So I walked up, thanked him for coming out, and he was so taken aback that I actually like approached him. And he was kind of nice, you know. He was, you know, he he didn't really like take the moment to be critical. He just like, oh yeah, thanks for doing this, whatever. And I thought, well, maybe I won him over. You know, maybe he's going to be on Team Inquirer now.
Yeah.
That he sees that we're real people.
Immediately subscribes.
Yeah, and all of that. And so get home from the candidate forum, turn on my phone. I see that I'm tagged in Twitter, you know.
No.
Yes. And it was at Duron Dixon. And he wrote, and I remember this like it was yesterday. I got to meet at Burl Love in person. Or he said, no, I got to meet at Burl Love at the Enquirer candidate forum. He's even less impressive in person.
Oh my gosh.
And you know what? I thought that was pretty clever. I was like, that's all right, okay. I mean, at least
you're
gonna.
Where do people get the audacity? That's
my question.
I remember
when you told me that. I was bummed I didn't get to meet him. No one pointed him out to me. And it's like, I wanted to meet him in person.
Meet him.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't hit me. Maybe he's
I haven't
like,
seen him online in a while.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
Twitter's
okay.
A lot different
maybe
now.
Maybe we need to do a wellness check or something. But all right. Well, should
that's
we wrap
so
this up?
Let's do it.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com, and producer Phil.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
And finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer for new subscribers.
Thanks again. See you next week.